Yep. And I want to start by just giving you a brief overview of the life cycle of a Kernza production system in a given year. So typically we plant in late summer, early fall, and we'll talk about a little bit more precisely about when that should be. But generally late summer, early fall, after we plant, the plant Kernza germinates, establishes, puts on vegetative biomass in the late fall, continues growing until the ground freezes and the snow flies. And then the Kernza resumes growth very early in the spring. We're starting to see the fields green up right now in certain parts of the state. And it'll grow just vegetatively till about mid-May. And then it bolts, elongates, and flowers, and then the grain is typically ready to harvest around mid-August. And we'll talk more about the timing of that later on in the presentation. After the grain is harvested and the straw is removed, the plant continues to grow just vegetatively. So you only get one grain harvest per year, but lots of biomass production. And then winter comes and the cycle starts over again with spring regrowth. So we're going to sort of go in order here with agronomics and talk about establishment, what research we've done related to successful establishment of Kernza. And most of that work has been focused on the timing of seeding. So ideally, we want to get Kernza seed in the ground as early as possible to let it produce enough biomass before overwintering, but that can be challenging depending on what the previous crop is. So there's lots of questions about whether or not we can plant Kernza after a soybean harvest, after harvesting corn for silage, or after small grains, and really success of that those different options relies or depends on when the seed gets planted. So the first thing we did was a seeding date trial. We planted seeds every 2 to 4 weeks, starting in mid-August. We went through the fall, so every 2 weeks into early December, and then even included a couple of seeding date options in the early spring. And we did this at three different locations. One in Roseau, Minnesota, up by Jade, in St. Paul, Minnesota. And we did it for 2 different years in St. Paul, and also down in Kansas, much warmer, drier environment. So I'm going to show some graphs for those who can see on the screen. The take-home message is that the earlier you can get seed in the ground, the greater your yields will be in the first production year, that next year. And we've also clearly shown that any plantings that occur in the spring do not produce seed that first year. So the second year in Minnesota, in the St. Paul site, it's very, very clear. You can see this decrease in grain yield every with every delayed 2 week of planting. So it's just really strong evidence that we want to get into that field as early as possible to seed. And the earliest we've gotten in for this trial was August 18th. And then our partners in Roseau got it in August 15th. And again, that's the seeding date that produced the greatest yields the next year. At our other location in Salina, we actually found that you can seed too early. And we believe that's related to water depletion in that particularly dry environment. So there is an optimal time to seed in by that Minnesota yet, but so right now the take-home message is the earlier the better. Next, I'm going to just talk a little bit about fertility. We've done quite a few nitrogen rate trials on Kernza over the last 4 or 5 years. Some of this has been published in peer-reviewed literature, and the the general take-home message there is the optimum nitrogen fertilizer rate is between about 55 and 75 pounds of nitrogen per acre. What we did observe in our previous studies is that when we apply nitrogen fertilizer at rates above 100 pounds per acre, we see real declines in grain yield, and that is largely due to lodging. So in the previous germplasm, the older genetics, the plants were significantly taller, and when we applied nitrogen at relatively high rates, those plants lodged and we lost yield. So we're going to continue to do these nitrogen rate trials using the new germplasm, Minnesota Clearwater, because it is shorter, and we expect that the new germplasm will be able to take more nitrogen and allocate it to the plants without or grain without lodging. So that nitrogen, optimum nitrogen rate could be changing with the new variety, and we'll keep you posted on that. Another question we often get is, what about timing of nitrogen application? For all of our previous studies, we've just applied all of the nitrogen in one shot in the spring, and we've been looking at split applications, early nitrogen application at kind of green up, and then splitting that with another application at elongation. And what we found is that splitting up nitrogen application in the spring doesn't affect grain yields. However, we did find that a fall application of the same rates indeed did increase grain yields. So this is rather preliminary in the fact that we've only collected this data for a couple of years and at a couple locations, and we're going to expand this project to confirm this result. But it looks like that you get greater yield increases when you apply the same amount of nitrogen in the fall compared to the spring. Now, this can be a controversial issue, especially with the state of Minnesota. MDA doesn't want to see fall nitrogen applications for a lot of crops in a lot of regions of the state. So we're also going to focus on measuring nitrogen loss when we apply nitrogen at that time. And of course, we are looking at intercropping legumes with Kernza. I think I've talked with a lot of you about this. Using the legumes as a organic source of nitrogen fixation and source of nitrogen for the Kernza grain. It's tricky. We've tried a lot of different forage legumes and native legume species as intercrops with Kernza, and we're seeing not very consistent results across these different legume species, and the results really vary across locations. So, like for example, in Rosemont, Minnesota, we had pretty good success with intercropping bird's foot trefoil. But at Lamberton, that legume did not do so well, and we see that white clover performed pretty well. And it really depends on the year. Weed management, I don't have a lot to say here, except that we have initiated a trial to collect the necessary data to get certain products labeled for use on Kernza. So that's the major problem, is that those conventional growers who want to use herbicides technically can't apply any herbicides onto Kernza, harvest the grain, and sell it because there's nothing approved for Kernza. So I have a list of the different treatments here on the screen, 2,4-D, clopyrrolid, MCPA, and combinations of those. So those are the three different products that we're seeking approval and registrations for. So we hope that at the earliest, those could be approved by this fall, but that work is in progress. I'll take a moment. Any questions? Yep.
Yeah, Kurt Kimber, and you don't have to answer right now, but how about adding nitrogen in an organic operation, you know, like compost or chicken litter or something like that?
Yep, we did a trial up actually in Roseau where we had, it was a nitrogen rate trial, and it was a split plot where we had urea as one source and composted poultry manure as another source. And we applied these products so that the nitrogen was content was accounted for in the two different products. And we didn't see very many differences. So I think that there's some differences in the later years of the study, and that was related to, I think, some of the organic nitrogen that was associated of the manure was being mineralized and providing a little bit more nitrogen to the crop as that stand aged. But there weren't very many differences in comparison to using urea for yield.
Yeah, Jake Carman here. Wonder if you've done any correlation with fertility levels and a quicker fall off on yield over 2 to 3 years.
So what we do know is that at those nitrogen rates, even the high ones, we're not sustaining yields. So we're not able to prevent the yield decline with stand age using nitrogen fertilizer. Now that could be related to the lodging issue though as well. So, you know, maybe the crop is becoming more and more limited by nitrogen, but we weren't able to get yields back up because the plant's still lodged. So I wouldn't rule that out just yet, that nitrogen can't help solve that problem. We still need to do more research to figure that out. It's a good question.
Jake, Scott Johnson here.
Hey, Scott.
Before I forget to ask this question, I want to continue with that nitrogen thing, but has anybody ever, for us organic guys, what I was wondering is if we get a flush of weeds, say in late spring, early summer, let's pick a number, when the stuff is 6 to 8 inches tall, if I mow that field down to kill the weeds, will the Kernza grow back and produce seed?
If you go out there and you can feel the node coming up the stem, if that's starting to, that stem is coming up, and if you can cut over the top of that, you're good to go. You'll still get the seed head to come up and you'll produce seed. And that has been done on a number of occasions for organic weed control. That is a product that works, but just make sure that you're either cutting above that node or that it hasn't come out of the crown yet.
Okay. Good to know. I went back to this nitrogen thing more out of curiosity than is the state recognizing the fact, and I say it as a fact, maybe it's not. You guys can chime in. If I'm using composted pelleted chicken manure, whether I put it on in fall or spring, I'm fairly confident that I'm not losing any of that like they're worried about. Is that the general consensus, or do they not recognize that, or, you know, every chime in if you know.
The folks who I work with at MDA understand that, and I think that there's still this discrepancy in like how the policy's made versus what so, you know, I'm confident that there are some of my colleagues in MDA totally recognize that and understand that. It's just, it hasn't been translated to changes in the policy, and that's what we hope to do too. Capable of working with a perennial crop, a perennial with that system's living all winter, that's going to capture that early in the spring.
We hope
to provide data to help that situation.
Jake, related to that then, if we're going to be seeding in August, doing seedbed prep in August and then seeding in August, wouldn't it be very appropriate to fertilize at that time?
Yeah, that would be probably the most risky time to do like a fall, if you want to call it a fall. But if you're seeding early enough in August, I would think that you'd be okay. If you're pushing that seeding into the fall, into September, and then you're applying the nitrogen, you know, the question there is the crop produce enough roots during that short period of time to capture the nitrogen? That's a good question that I don't know the answer to yet.
Okay.
I would be very confident in applying nitrogen in the fall to a established stand. I agree with you, Scott, that you're probably not losing much, if any.
Okay.
That study, when you talked about the trial putting fall on fall application, was that, that wasn't in the initial establishment year then? That was later?
Right. That was after the first production year.
Okay.
So back to the question about manure versus urea, for instance, you know, chemical nitrogen. If you do put manure on in the fall, pelletized chicken litter or something like that, is that nitrogen? So I guess there's some percentage that's ammonia, right? And so that's probably at risk of leaching because it turns into nitrate.
Yep.
I think, but then I think there's like 80% that's not ammonia.
Right.
Is that stable or is that at risk of leaching?
That is relatively stable. Depends on when it gets mineralized. If that soil is still pretty warm and moist in the fall, some of that is going to be converted, that organic nitrogen, to inorganic sources. And then it could be lost depending on the conditions, and not just through water, but into the atmosphere. I should clarify that all these fall application studies have only been conducted with urea and not manure yet. Any other questions about fertility before I move on? Okay.
One quick one. When you talked about the interseeding legumes,
yeah.
What was the row spacing on the currents of seeding?
That is has changed with every one of our trials. So, and I think that's a really important component of a successful intercropping system that we need to nail down. So in some cases, we've had pretty wide kerns or rows and we'd plant just one row of alfalfa or legume in between. Sometimes we've even widened that further to like 24, 30 inches and done two rows of legumes. We've done every other row, legume kernza on 6-inch rows. And then we've also drilled the kernza into rows and broadcast seeded or the legumes over the top. And there's no consistent result just yet. I can't recommend one or the other. You get a nice looking stand with the wider kernza rows and really lush legume areas in between, but widening that kernza row really can reduce yields because you just have a lower plant population. So we're working on finding that sweet spot. And I think, you know, every year we're getting closer and closer to it. And this last study that we initiated with Kurt and Scott, they're doing an on-farm component. We really focused on looking at the row spacing on the institutional trial. So we just planted that this fall, and I think we'll have a better recommendation for that configuration after this first year.
And the interseeding was always done at the same time as the kerns was seeded then?
Most of the time. I don't want to say all the time. I think there's been a couple of cases where we've seeded the legume in the fall, but it didn't establish, and then we ended up going back and overseeding with a frost seeding.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. So the next topic here is harvest challenges. The ultimate question is swathing versus direct combining. And there are, I think all of you know the trade-offs with both of these. So you have these advantages with swathing and combining, more flexible harvest timing in terms of when you can knock the stand down, anytime after physiological maturity. And I wouldn't even say that it really anytime you see, you have a good window of weather and, you know, you're far enough along into seed grain fill that you're going to get a good yield. Another advantage of this is that if the weather's great, you may not have to mechanically dry it. There's been a few cases in a few different regions where that's possible. Again, it kind of depends on your situation. It also seems to result in pretty clean seed and grain. Everything's adjusted right. Disadvantages is that it's you got to have that couple days of dry weather after windrowing. And then, so that in that sense, the grain's a bit vulnerable to contamination if there is any precipitation before you can pick it up. Advantages to the direct combining, fewer passes. You can kind of get in and get out, and you don't have to stress out about grain lying in a windrow. Disadvantages, it seems to come off the field wetter. Doesn't seem like we can really use this without having drying capabilities. If we wait too long, if you try to wait the lay harvest so that the grain is drier coming out of the field, you're going to lose some to shattering. So that's a major breeding priority. We're trying to create the new varieties that don't shatter as much, but right now that's still an issue to consider. So that comes to this question, when is the best time to harvest? So if we just consider moisture of the seed, it's pretty high for a while as the seed fills, and then there's this break point, and think of it as like a phase change. Then there's this rapid decline in moisture content, and then again it levels off at some relatively stable moisture content. And we've quantified this just recently. We've measured when this break point occurs. So we're getting an idea of how many, and we can all estimate what this will be in our fields if we measure and count growing degree days after the plant begins flowering. So as soon as the plant flowers and you see pollen out there in the field, write down that date and then keep track of how many growing degree days accumulate since that date. And what we figure out is around 450 degree days after flowering is when that rapid dry down of grain starts to occur. Now that needs to correspond also with a change in the seed size. So during grain fill, you know, seed mass is increasing. We also want to measure the rate of that increase and then figure out how long it takes from flowering for intermediate wheatgrass to reach its maximum seed weight. And we've just finished analyzing some of this data from the past couple of years, and it takes about 900 growing degree days for those seeds to reach maximum size. Now, I mentioned this issue with lodging. So if you consider these, or not lodging, shattering, if you consider all these variables, think just about yield in the field, it's going to increase as the seed fills, but then it's going to reach a point, a peak, and then it's going to decrease because seeds are going to shatter. And we've pretty much been able to calculate when that occurs. So the peak seed yield, grain yield on a spike occurs about 600 growing degree days after flowering. Now, if you're listening closely, that means that I'm recommending that you should harvest grain around 600 growing degree days, which is earlier than the maximum seed weight that occurs. And that's because lodging is occurring prior to grain being at its maximum size, and shattering is occurring, I should say. So that is a relatively new finding, and that now we can recommend about when to start harvesting to maximize grain yield in the field. kind of prevent that loss from shattering.
Can I ask a quick question, Jake?
Yes, definitely.
At that, let's just, for hypothetical, at 600 drawing degree units, that's what you're talking about, right?
Yep.
What is a ballpark number? What is the moisture of that grain at that point?
That is a very good question. I can tell you exactly what it is. Let me just go back to my figure here and look. So the moisture is going to be right about 35 to 30%. 30 to 35%. Yep. Can I, Jade, are you still on the line? Because, and I'm wondering, I think this is pretty close to the recommended moisture content of ryegrass harvest. So if you're on the line, you can confirm that.
Yeah, Jake, they kind of recommend that 37.5% moisture there on the ryegrass, just because it seems like at 35%, the shelling losses get to be considerably more. And if you're over that 40 to 42, you're giving up some test weight and yield on that. So,
yeah, so that's it. Sounds like Kearns is kind of falling in that same set of windows there for moisture content test weight. Any other questions on that?
Yeah, Jake.
Go ahead, Jake. Go ahead.
Okay, Mike Peterson here. On that, the moisture content, are we setting our moisture testers for wheat or something like that? What's this grain relevant to as we're trying to analyze it?
Yeah, we've set it for oats because it still has the hull on it.
Okay.
And this is the problem. So this isn't going to be very reliable at this point. So in the past, when you'd pull a handful of grain out of the combine, I would say 50 to 60% of it still had the hulls on it. And then the rest was naked seed. Well, that's changing with the new genetics. We're selecting for free threshing varieties. And so now I would say maybe 80% is naked. And that's those values, that difference is totally going to change how a moisture meter reads. I would recommend doing like a microwave test at this point. Carmen knows how that works and it can be reliable. And otherwise, you know, what we also can start doing is just try testing Kearns with different, at different settings and then sharing that, among this network.
Okay.
Right. Or your microwave test and your grain moisture tester test to try to find out a relevant number, maybe, and you could benchmark there. But like you say, it's going to change too with the number of hulls. So if a person gets to a position where you have to commercially dry it, is it advised then to try to dehull the stuff in another process before you run it through the dryer so you can get a pretty reliable storage moisture?
What, when you say commercial dryer, what do you mean? Like a grain bin?
Would it be an old dryer bin? Yeah.
Yeah, we can do that now with taking it right out of the combine to a bin, a grain bin, and drying it down. Yep.
Yeah, because your batch dryers are they're going to be too porous, right? You're going to lose seed through the dryer itself.
Yeah, and we don't have a whole lot of experience working with different drying techniques, so.
Yeah, so like a bin dryer, you could cover the floor of a bin dryer, level your quantity, and then you could turn that down to a real low heat, I would think, and dry it almost like you'd dry soybeans with a real low even heat over time.
Yeah,
I've dried wheat that way too, and it works pretty decent. If you get solved, another option is to have the favorable air temperature outside and just air dry it, huh?
Yeah, yep, we've done more of that.
Okay.
And Jake, any indication of the impact of yield loss between the 600 and 900 growing degree days?
Yeah, we can calculate that with our data. and present that. So, right. So if you want, if you don't have the capacity to dry it and you want to wait, you'd rather have drier grain coming off the field. What's that yield penalty going to be? Right. We can predict that for sure. I don't know what that is off the top of my head for those specific growing degree day units, but we can do that.
Okay. Because the other thing, you know, we worked this last summer with the stripper head as well, mm-hmm. in straight combining, and it might be that we could harvest closer to 600 rather than 900 and not get as much moisture in the grain because we would be taking very little, if any, of the green stem.
Yeah, right. And then you raise a good point here too, is that the material that ends up, the chaff and other material that ends up in the combine, really affects what the moisture content is of the lot itself rather than just the seed. So all that research we've done is through hand harvesting, and it hasn't considered how this product will flow through a different combine. So that's another element that needs to be studied.
Good.
Just got a few more things before we turn it over to Colin. I'm running a little longer here than the agenda says, but we got issues dealing with yield longevity. As this Kernza stands age, those stands get more and more dense. Volunteers emerge, the plants reproduce with rhizomes. Rhizomes don't spread widely like other invasive grasses, but they do, those result in increased stand density. So in that case, we're seeing more root biomass and competition among the for resources below ground, and we're seeing fewer and fewer seed heads. So what we've tried to do is disturb that space in between the rows. And we've done that by cultivating in between rows in these aged sod-bound stands and band sprayed herbicides in between rows for those who are considering conventional production. And prior to any treatments, you know, we found that we know that yields are pretty much stable. I'm showing some figures here, so it's kind of hard to describe this one without being able to see it. In short, what we found is that the inner row disturbance treatments, whether it be cultivation or herbicide application, applied at different times of the year, did not bring back an already sod-bound stand to life. So they did not, they were not effective at bringing yields back up after they started to decline already. Now we're testing these same techniques in brand new stands. So starting production right with these practices, these inner row disturbance practices. And we're going to be going into year three this year for some of these. So kind of this is the year to see if they do indeed work and prevent that yield decline with stand age. So stay tuned for that. Quickly want to go over dual use potential. I think a lot of you know something about this or have heard from us about this. Typically, you know, if we're just managing this for a grain crop, you harvest the grain in late summer and then remove the straw. Well, I mentioned that it produces a substantial amount of leafy, high-quality forage in the spring. Before that stem begins to elongate, you could graze that or harvest that material for forage. The stand continues to grow after grain harvest and produces pretty good, decent quality forage throughout the fall. You could also graze that or harvest it. And if you're really aggressive, and paid attention to timing of things, theoretically, you could use that forage in the spring, get a grain harvest this summer, and then also use the forage in the fall. So the first study, which was conducted by Mitch Hunter, we looked at not grazing, but just defoliation, just harvesting the biomass at those different timings in the spring, the fall, and the spring and fall, and looked to see if that removal of biomass affected the next year's grain yields. After the first year, there was no differences in grain yield, but the second year, we actually saw a little bit of an increase in grain yield compared in the system that was harvested or defoliated in the spring and the fall. We saw a little bit of a boost in grain yield compared to the control plots where we didn't do anything. So that's a promising finding, is that removing this biomass and getting another revenue stream from the system actually increased grain yields. That trend did not hold as the stand age. What we found out was that really there was no effect of biomass removal on grain yield for most years, which also isn't, that's not necessarily a negative finding. It's evidence that you can use this for a dual purpose, dual function crop and not hurt grain yields. Now, is it profitable to do that, to go out in the field at these different times and cut hay and rake it and dry it and bale it up? If we just look at, first of all, again, I'm showing some more figures with profitability as a response to the different row spacings and harvest timings. And this crop managed just for grain, if you don't remove any straw or forage, doesn't break even at the fourth year. So the first year, it's relatively profitable. Second year, most systems, you're making money. By the third year, it's declined quite a bit. By the fourth year, it's ready to turn it into a forage crop. But if you can use the straw, that system is certainly viable, economically viable, for all 4 years that we tested it. Even when grain yields declined by the fourth year, the straw itself paid for the system. So it can be economically viable. Haying it didn't add much value to it just because of the input requirements to the haying process and the lower yields coming off of those cuttings. I think that if you could graze it, it would be a much better economic system. So right now the take-home message is that the summer straw is very valuable, and fall haying increases profitability a little bit, but grazing would probably be more financially successful, and profitability is highest in the 15 and cent, well, 6 and 12-inch row spacings. Termination. Oh, any questions on that?
I was just going to ask a quick question. Intensity of grazing. Did you measure that, or any standards of intensity of grazing, fall and or spring?
Yeah. So, I'm not showing. I don't have any of that research to show you right now. But yeah, we did do some mob grazings in the spring and in the fall, and then for one study, we did a lower stocking rate grazing throughout the fall. So it was a strip grazing project where we moved them into different paddocks every 3 or 4 days at a little bit lower of a stocking density. And then in that situation, we're really interested to see, does the timing of grazing in the fall, would that affect grain yields? And right now, from our preliminary results, it says no. So the strip grazing was a pretty nice system to utilize that forage, that regrowth in the fall. But most of what we've been looking at is these relatively higher density mob graze type events.
Okay.
Hey, Jake, question if I may?
Yep.
Has anybody looked at kind of like it's almost like contour strips or whatever? So let's say you have 3 18-inch strips, and then you till those and plant those and do that, kind of moving across those three strips so you're kind of rotating. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. So you're saying, elaborate a little bit.
So it's like, just say you've got, you know, three, I'm going to call them fields, and the fields are 18 inches wide and they abut one another.
Okay.
And then, you know, maybe the first year you plant all three, and then in the second year you go and terminate the, you go till up the leftmost strip and plant it and let that go. The second year you do the middle strip. Third year you do the third strip, and then you rotate around.
Yeah, we have not tried anything like that. What would you what were you thinking of for other crops that would go into that?
Keep it in Kernza.
Oh, and just wondering if Kernza.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that would get around kind of the root bound or, you know, something like that.
Huh. That's a good idea, and I hadn't thought about that. The one thing I'd be a little bit concerned with is planting Kernza after Kernza, and if there's any, like, allelopathy or anything like that. We don't know of any, but it would be something to pay attention to if we tried that. But no, I'm not aware of anybody who's tried something like that.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that.
So with respect to the last comments there, it would be basically a relay crop. Mm-hmm. So you'd vary the age of your Kernza, but you could also, in those inner strips, you could relay some other form of a legume or maybe, and then possibly break that allelopathy too. So you could kind of somewhat crop rotate, but stagger the age of your stand.
Yeah, get a legume in there to fix some nitrogen and. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of when Kurt was describing that. Yeah.
So, Jake, so there is allelopathy, so you really can't follow. You have to put another crop in between.
Don't know for sure. No. This leads me into my next point. The last topic is determination and reproduction. And actually, we don't plan on testing any Kernza following Kernza. That's something, yeah, we should do soon. But this last fall, we terminated Kernza using a few different methods. And really the big question is, when's the best time to kill the Kernza so that you get an successful termination of it? And then how to do that without blowing all the carbon that you just sequestered in the soil into the atmosphere. And then the last question that we hope to address with this study is, what are the best crops to follow Kernza? What performs well? Kernza being a perennial in a rotation, we're probably getting better mycorrhizal colonization and growth than a typical rotation because you're giving it that time for those fungal networks to grow. We might see something different from other rotations in terms of phosphorus. So now we've terminated Kernza using different tillage techniques, and then we're going to split those strips up and plant corn, soybeans, small grain, forage legume, and see if any of those perform better than others following that 4-year stand of Kernza. And other future research, this is my last slide, I think. We're going to focus on nitrogen and phosphorus interactions and look to see if phosphorus fertilization can prevent lodging. And if so, does that mean we could get a little bit more N fertility on the system and increase yields, and then also look at phosphorus, nitrogen, and how that interacts with the mycorrhizal fungi, and in turn how that might influence carbon sequestration and soil health. So I just want to acknowledge all the funding agencies and a lot of people who help with this research. And then if there's any other questions before we move on to commercialization, I'd be happy to answer them.
Jake, just one quick question for me here. This is Al. And unless I missed it, right at the very beginning in terms of planting, establishing the crop, did you mention something about no-till planting versus some tillage on the seed bed before planting. We are running late in terms of the time, but I'm told by Colin that we can just stay on the line as long as folks want to stay on the line. So as far as I'm concerned, this has been a fantastic conversation, and I'm able and willing to continue for as long as you guys are. But yeah, before we move to commercialization, maybe if you didn't mention it, maybe just mention that piece.
Yep, we've had a successful establishment of Kernza using both no-till and prepared seed bed drilling methods. The biggest concern there is you want to make sure that your seed's not getting too deep if you're using a grain drill. So set it as shallow as you can. We're shooting for that 1/2 inch to 3/4 inch seeding depth. And we've had better luck achieving that with a no-till setup. But then, of course, there's all the issues you got to deal with no-till, especially if you're following another small grain, which is what works with the timing of things. If we're harvesting our small grains in early August, we have to watch out for the volunteers. We want to make sure that we can reduce the competition of any small grain crop volunteers going into the kernza of planting.
And then on the seeding rate, did you mention something on that about, especially this year, 2020?
You know, we've done a lot of different experiments with seeding rates, and we've gone down to like 5 pounds an acre and had successful stands. We're still recommending seeding rates a little bit higher than that, and something around 10 to 12 pounds per acre. But it really depends on what the row spacing is going to be. So if you apply, and you all know this, I'm sure, but yeah, if you can't take 10 pounds of seed and plant it into 6-inch rows and then take 10 pounds of seed and plant it into 15-inch rows, you're going to have very different plant populations. So I think Colin has this. We made a little spreadsheet that adjusts the pure live seeding rate depending on what row spacing you can use. So. Okay. Colin might be able to tell us where we can find that.
Yeah, we have a table based on row spacing and germination rate that looks at seeding rate based on your situation and the lot that you're pulling from.
Where can people find that?
I can distribute that to this group.
All right, thanks.
Yep.
Okay, if there are no other immediate questions for Jake, of course, we can continue this conversation about the agronomics of this particular crop. A lot to learn. It's kind of exciting in a lot of ways. But without delaying any longer, really, the whole conversation about commercialization process, of course, if we grow it, we harvest it, we put it into a bin, we got to sell it. So... before we go to the conversation about the grain selling, I'm really glad, Jake, that you mentioned about the dual purpose of the crop, the forage end of it, and how that is a serious driver of profitability on this perennial grain. So we absolutely have to incorporate that in our thinking about what this crop can mean to your farm business long-term as you work on soil health issues with it as well. All right, so Colin, help us walk through the whole commercialization process and market development piece.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'll do the best I can here to keep it very brief. I think a lot of you have heard some of this. I am going to go over some of the introductory material around the licensing process because that's really important to this. Connie, also chime in and correct me on anything. But then I want to reserve as much time as possible for this group to talk together about how this cluster, so to speak, particularly in southern Minnesota, we also have a good number of people on from southwestern Minnesota, are going to work together to aggregate and handle and market their grain collaboratively. That is ultimately a question for those that are on the early end of this as a producer. And so I think the more time we have to talk about that, the better. So I also just have a couple slides to share, but I'll try to not make them too visually specific. I'll bounce around here and hang with me. I'm going to share my screen. Okay, you guys have my screen?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So I just wanted to share a bit more on U of M's progress in breeding to make sure you understand the benefits of the latest variety. Here you can see some of the recent gains in the breeding program and where we're headed. So very quickly, the U of M is heading toward a free threshing variety. Currently, I think we're in about that 50% free threshing, but you see in this cycle four, just in the last year of where the next varieties are heading, have made a 25% increase in free threshing. So that's very exciting. And you can see some visuals here about where Kearns has started. So in the upper right of your screen, see intermediate wheatgrass forage varieties. And that may be like the first Kearnsa that anybody here saw. That middle set is where we currently are, and then relative to a wheat crop. Here you see a selection of Min 1504 was the experimental name of ultimately the variety that was named Min Clearwater. Just shows some of those improved benefits in terms of seed size, yield, and reduced lodging. Essentially, we're showing about a 20 to 25% yield increase relative to other existing germplasm. And actually, I just got word from Praveen that he said they've assessed a two-year total yield increase of 38%. So you're looking at about a 40% yield boost from this latest variety relative to what else is available. We released this variety, Min Clearwater, in beginning of August last year, very small scale, added about a dozen commercial plots. Concurrently, we went through a commercial seed increase process that resulted in us now having about 25,000 pounds of seed available. But based on the way the early Kearns seed market is, that accounts for basically all of the seed that's available nationally. So there's a lot of pressure on the University of Minnesota's seed supply. We are prioritizing that seed for Minnesota growers, but also want you all to know that that's one of the reasons that we need to keep a pretty judicious seed licensing process. And that's going to be the next topic. But essentially, we have grown out about 25,000 pounds of seed that will be available for commercial production. We think that's roughly enough to add between, 1,000 to 2,000 acres of commercial production. We're still waiting on the final clean out on three smaller lots, which is going to allow us to assess final germination rates and acreage potential. That seed is being cleaned by our partner, Minnesota Native Landscapes, at their production farm in Foley, Minnesota. And I'll go through how seed will be distributed momentarily. Here are our 2020 seed licensing terms. We do have a strong priority for Minnesota growers. That is pretty much everyone on this call, but we are getting a lot of inquiries from outside Minnesota. We do still require at this time organic management practices. That does not mean certified organic. It means that no agrochemical applications have yet been approved for use on Kearns. The market is trending towards certified organic grain, but I think anybody that brings a non-certified organic grain product to market that meets spec is not going to have a whole lot of trouble selling it. And we also have a minimum planting scale, 20 acres or more. Ideally, we'd like to see initial commercial plots more in the 30 to 40 acre range. We just find that in working with processors and other users, that anything below that scale, an absolute minimum, is hard for them to make the case to deal with. And also we find that it helps prioritize this for growers if they're growing a bit more of it. Beyond those strict requirements, we do have some preferences. We are eager to see growers that are committed to marketing their crop in partnership with other growers. We do want to see folks who have appropriate equipment and post-harvest storage. So again, when we look at, say, harvesting at 30% moisture and marketing this down at, something like 13% moisture, if you don't have the appropriate equipment to take it to that stage, we would be pretty concerned about licensing you, a 50-acre plot. Ideally, growers experienced growing small grains and selling into food-grade markets. Our processing partners could not stress enough that the biggest change here in promoting this crop is that there's a lot of folks involved that are looking at going to the Kernza that haven't sold into a food grade market. I think a lot of the people on this call have, and so you're familiar with that, especially our organic guys. But that's something to keep in mind. Those are different markets. Means you'll likely have to be holding that product on farm, even if you have a solid market outlet. They might want you to hold it on farm prior to processing to preserve product quality. Also carries higher risks of not meeting a stricter spec. Those specs right now, at least for the earliest processor, is they don't want to take anything in the door above 4 parts per million on vomitoxin, and they don't want to send anything out the door post-processing over 2 parts per million. And they'll also require advanced testing before taking in that lot. You already heard the potential for dual use grain and forage. We would very much like to see folks who can make use of that revenue potential. There's also strong support early on for siting this crop for environmental benefit, particularly growers located in or near drinking water supply management areas or wellhead protection areas are a strong priority. And there are some resources available cost share for those plantings. And we have these priority cluster areas, one of which, you know, I think almost everyone on the call is in one of those areas very intentionally. So, okay, so I'm gonna unshare screen, stop share, and go to another document. Just wanna make sure you all have access to this and reshare. All of those terms are laid out in a variety of resources that we have made available to you all. If you don't have this letter, please let us know and we can distribute it to you. It has all the relevant information you'll need on licensing, how to submit an application, basic information about our seed supply, and all of those licensing terms. So I will just go down right here to the first step to get started, which sounds like a number of you already have done. To get started with the process, if you're interested in growing Kernza and have not yet submitted an application, there's this link here. I can distribute this again with that seeding rate table. But there's a Kernza grower application, and the process that this is going to roll through is that all initial inquiries are submitted to our partner, the Land Institute, who owns the Kernza trademark. All Minnesota inquiries will be forwarded to Connie Carlson and myself, and we are vetting those inquiries. I know some of you have applied, and we're going to undertake our first round of approvals near term here. We have enough now that we can kind of stack those up. I think most of the folks on this call have demonstrated significant enough interest and thoughtfulness that I think you're in a pretty good position, but just want you to know that there is a vetting process. And not everyone that's interested is going to be able to grow. If we see a number of red flags that think it's, you know, not a good fit, or it's, you know, you don't have the appropriate setup, then we might ask you to defer until just wait a year or two. So that's where those things currently lie. So then you'll hear back from us after submitting that Kernza grower application. We will first, you know, send our approval to the Land Institute, and you will hear from them. And then there's a licensing process that you are licensed to be a Kernza grower by the Land Institute. And that I have some documents on that to just give you a sense of what that looks like. This is the Identity Preserve Guideline, Program Guidelines. It includes mutual responsibilities, commitments. It includes grain standards, both for seed and grain. If anybody wants to take a look at this, if you're really strongly considering growing Kernza and have any concerns about that, get in touch with me. I'm not sure I can share the contract prior to being approved, but I could talk you through it. And there's also a number of record requirements that the Land Institute and the University of Minnesota are looking to document with licensed early commercial growers. So you will be licensed by the Land Institute to be a Crenshaw grower, and you will also be licensed by the University of Minnesota under a non-exclusive agronomic license to grow this variety. Just a heads up that that U of M license does include a licensing fee that is upon sale of grain products, 3% of the gross sale of grain products, and that goes directly into the University of Minnesota's Variety Development Fund to continue the breeding program for Kernza. So we're trying not to gouge anyone here, and that only comes into play upon a successful sale, so it's not a front-end cost, flat rate, or a per-acre payment. It's only if you get all the way down to a successful sale. So that's that. If all of this goes through and you're approved, seed will be distributed by Minnesota Native Landscapes from their Foley location. Seed can be picked up from their production farm, or they can ship. Grower pays shipping. They can ship by the bag or by the pallet. I believe it's more cost effective if you go in by the pallet. I think it's, they said it's either, I think they said it's $150 per pallet. And so if growers in particular clusters wanted to get together and put that seed order in together, I think that would be more efficient for everyone. They can also ship by the bag, or you can head to their location and pick that up. Seed will be distributed by them, but ultimately the actual sale, it will be through MCIA on behalf of the University of Minnesota. So Minnesota Native Landscapes is just a distribution partner. They're not calling the shots on who is approved and who's not. and so you can direct all of those inquiries to the Land Institute to start. Any questions yet on that before we move forward? That's all just kind of logistics, process, licensing, distribution. Any questions?
Hey, Colin, would it make sense to talk about the distinction between intermediate wheatgrass and Kernza?
Sure, and Connie, also jump in if I'm off here. Kernza is a registered name. It's a trademark name that's owned by the Land Institute, and it applies to finished grain products of improved intermediate wheatgrass varieties. So just keep in mind that the type of plant you're growing is an improved intermediate wheatgrass variety. The trademark and the use of the trademark applies to those finished grain products. So there's kind of some nuance there. I don't want to, you know, go way down the rabbit hole with it. I think it's okay to say, you know, I'm a Kernza grower, but there is a little bit of nuance there in terms of the use of the trademark relative to the plant name, its technical name and its common name, and then its trade name.
Colin.
Yes.
These documents you've been reading off of, I don't want to go into them in detail now, but I'm not sure I'm familiar with all of them. So you will get these out to all of us?
I'll check with Tessa if I can share these, because these are the contracts that licensed growers sign.
Okay.
And so you should certainly have one. I can make sure you get them. Okay. But I could also, at the very least, if you have questions about what's included in them, I could talk through them with you one-on-one. And I think Tessa would probably say it's okay to share them. They're legal contracts of another organization that I hesitate from saying what I can do. Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Other questions? Next step is going to be to talk about the enterprise budget and a supply chain model to look at the finances of this. And then was going to lead into a kind of group conversation on the cluster level aggregation and marketing. But any questions on licensing, distribution, vetting, any of that?
Maybe more of a production question here. This is Mike Peterson. So we grow it, and its potential for to be a commercial grain. Would you also consider then some of that, if the stand looks good and things are favorable, that would go for seed also? Is that ever a decision that's made throughout the year that maybe you guys would want to save some of it for seed?
Sure. So that's a good question that leads into the strategy for seed production moving forward. The University of Minnesota contracted, I would call them soft contracts, handshake deals essentially, produce about 100 acres of seed increase. Moving forward, our goal is very quickly to either move seed production and sales either into the hands of, I would say, 1 to 3 seed, established seed companies, or a producer cooperative that would be working together to grow and market Kernza seed and grain. Our ability to do that is contingent on a group of growers getting together and wanting to do that. But I would be very open to, you know, awarding preferential access to seed production to a group of growers that would be producing that seed. And maybe they wouldn't have to sell it directly. They could sell it to Albert Lea. But I just want you all to know that the university itself, University of Minnesota, is not committing to buy and increase seed volume as early as later this year. We would like to have an established commercial system for growing and marketing Min Clearwater seed. So ultimately, that'll be the decision of individual producers and those licensed seed companies.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. So Jake talked a little bit about the economics. I'm sorry for all of the bouncing around of screen sharing here, but just want to show you some of the resources we have available here. This is a simplified crop enterprise budget that can just start to help understand the basic finances of growing Kernza. You can see here we've included, the key here is that we can distribute it and you can vary it for your own costs. It's not fixed, but all of this is linked up so that if we wanted to, you know, if you have a more expensive land rental, you can look at how that's going to affect your gross and net returns and total costs. So we have this resource that's available. Generally speaking, what I have in here is some basic assumptions. Our seed cost of $4 per pound, use of, I believe, let's see here, 12 pounds per acre. Devil's always in the details, of course. I've set a flat rate on revenue of $1 per pound, which is a very common starting point for folks who are going to take this product to farm gate, although you very, very well may see more than that. With a yield in the first year of 500 pounds per acre. And you can see that the gross revenue coming in the first year around $900, average cost in the first year, usually pencil out between $325 and $400, which suggests you are looking at a net return, at least in the scenario, in the first year around $500. Again, this is very simplified. It's contingent on a lot of things, but this is a resource we can distribute and help you understand based on your inputs, based on your equipment, and how you all do that at the farm level, that you could consider the sort of farm level economics of this. When it comes to the Kernza supply chain, gets a little more fun. I'm gonna share this. But this is another tool we have to help you understand at the lot level, based on your acreage, yield, and pricing structure, lays out all the other costs in the supply chain for a variety of scenarios, including non-certified organic, certified organic, making use of the forage, or not making use of the forage. And so this tool, I can work with you individually and perhaps also at a cluster level to think about your region's potential production scale and what that would look like for, say, a group of growers, whether it's a formal cooperative or a cooperating group, what your production potential and revenue situation might look like. A question that's been asked in the past is rough average yields at a commercial scale. We saw last year at around 500 pounds per acre, the maximum of about 800 pounds per acre. In terms of final finished grain, you have about 60 to 70% loss of that material in the cleaning and dehulling process. So at that average of 500 pounds per acre, you would be looking at about 150 to 200 pounds of finished dehulled grain per acre coming out of that system. This analysis also looks at what reasonable price points would be for end user buyers to get a sense of, like, in the marketplace, what this grain would look like. And this scenario here shows that there's finished buyer pricing that could vary anywhere from $5 to $8 per pound currently. And it's pretty consistent with what we've seen in the marketplace, buyers paying anywhere from around $3.50 to $7 per pound, depending on whether it's organic or not, and what the current market availability is. So this tool is available. There's a lot of numbers in it that look at plot level or region level production, costs throughout the chain, including transportation, dockage, processing costs, storage costs, marketing and distribution costs. And I tried to attach that as thoroughly as possible to model out what reasonable grain volumes and price points would look like, as well as at the very end there, a final revenue potential scenario. So this is a tool we can sit down and work through together. Any questions about either of these? No?
How is it available?
I can sit down with you, and I think the enterprise budget is definitely distributable, and I think this, actually for everyone on this call, I can send this out. I can send out both the enterprise budget and the supply chain model.
That would be good. I'd appreciate that.
Okay, yeah. I'll do that. And I've only been hesitant to do that so far because I want everyone to make sure they know this is a modeling exercise. Everything in these is subject to change, I think, especially on that supply chain front. Say things like processing costs, things like storage and distribution costs. But the good news is we can change one of these numbers, and those changes will flow throughout the model into price points and volumes and all that good stuff. Any other questions on that? No?
I just want to make a comment on sharing that information. It's very valuable. I mean, yep. The setting, the price for the buying and all that is a pretty consistent. That's an upfront cost that we know. And the end cost of what is available or possible is a really nice piece of the puzzle to put together. So thank you.
Right. Yeah, and I would also encourage this group, you know, these are costs in the system, but as many of you know, when you price things on cost alone, it often doesn't account for all the risks involved, right? And what something's worth is what someone's willing to pay for it, not just what you accrued in producing it, right? And so there's a lot of costs in that system that when it comes to marketing, subsequent group conversation here, is that I think that requires a little more savvy understanding in the marketplace of what this grain is really worth to those companies, not just you should sell it for, you know, all the costs of the system. You could think about what it's worth to those folks and that you are being adequately compensated for all of those environmental benefits, the marketing potential, all that, right? So I'll just give you the tools, but, you know, they're costs in the system, not necessarily recommended prices. Let's put it that way. Okay. Any other questions? No? Okay, so the subsequent topic is more of a group conversation. I want to lay out the kind of the stage of where the marketing conversation is currently at. We are hosting tomorrow a group of leading national Kernza producers, which is still a very small group between Minnesota and Kansas, to look at whether cross-regional collaboration and development of a Kernza marketing cooperative is an appropriate next step. We have one grower in particular, Carmen, here on the line. I think I shared out with you. Maybe I haven't yet, but he's written now, I think, 6 white papers on... 6 short, white, very thoughtful white papers on proposed marketing structure for Kernza. And I would be interested to hear from you all on the line your willingness to engage in some sort of more formal marketing of this grain, if you are indeed an approved producer. What thoughts and concerns do you have about more formally organizing, or are you comfortable pursuing an individualized strategy for this?
Join I guess together. I'll go first. What's that?
Go ahead.
I would say join together. Get in yeah. The thing going together. I'm a union electrical contractor, and that's my other job.
And the more you can stay together, the better off we'll all be.
I feel we've got a product here, or a crop that's got, we know the seed source. If we can stick together to know the market, we're going to be farmers that are more purposeful than, if you take into account in the state of where the nation is right now, mm-hmm. and what you've seen in the, even the beef and the pork market lately, the packers have put a premium on the boxed meat, and they've downgraded the value of the farmer's product on the hoof. That's stealing. If we can go forward and develop some kind of our own market that we're in better control and provide a good product, I feel it's worth the initiative to stick together.
But absolutely.
So
just the last few days will prove to us what, you know, we may need Big Brother in here sooner or later. I would rather not be a part of a group that, you know, catered to large conglomerates if we could help it.
Hmm. Amen.
I don't think anybody wants to just have a whole bin full of Kernza and try and figure out where to go with it.
Exactly. And that's honestly, that's the answer where we were glad to hear. Obviously, as someone said on one of the last grower calls, devil's always in the details, and there's a lot of front end work that we're looking at here to work together with you all, and the U of M Forever Green Initiative is happy to, you know, facilitate that conversation, put some effort into it. But, you know, cooperatives or companies planned by other people that aren't going to run them are not usually super successful. So it's going to require the, you know, the elbow grease. And I think you all are up for that, which is great. We are in a situation right now that I think we need to intervene in pretty quickly. We do have individual growers out there hawking their lot that they're either still holding or their seed individually to the early group of buyers. And so I think the more we can do to step forward in a very intentional way, the better. I think the high level message I want to share from this conversation is that I am very eager. You know, I do not call any shots on this for the University of Minnesota, but we can bend the arc. And my real goal here is to put the future of this first variety and perhaps subsequent varieties in the hands of growers directly. So I would not be against 2020 while we're pulling all this together, but maybe as early as 2021. You know, could be an exclusive license to produce this variety. And with the advent of substantially improved genetics, we talked to our Office of Technology Commercialization about this last week. And they said we need to be very careful about, we can't commit intellectual property that doesn't exist yet to a group that doesn't exist yet. But if you all organize and put all of the right pieces in place, they would be very willing to look primarily and very seriously at that group. And they have a lot of leeway and are also looking to recommendations from what to do on that front. So our next immediate step on that is we have this cross-region tomorrow. That's kind of a smaller call. But Carmen, would you be comfortable with me sharing out your writings on this to this group? I think so far it was only sent to that Minnesota, Kansas small group, but would you be okay with me sharing those out?
I certainly would, Colin. And first of all, I just wanted to mention that the comments I just heard really excited me because I've been thinking about it for quite some time, as you know, Colin, and to hear the sentiment that was expressed here with the two or three or four people that commented, it tells me that many of us are already on the same page on this. And, you know, it's going to be not only figuring out the markets, but this is a whole new grain. And so we're going to have to, I think, hold each other's hands, even as we learn how to plant it, how to grow it, and how to harvest it and store it. And so if we've got this group that's going to bring themselves together, I think we really can go a long ways in forming this strong marketing co-op, if we want to call it that. And so No problem, Colin, sharing that those papers at all. And those are my ideas, but I'm certainly open to any additional comments on them or about them. And the other thing I would, given what I've heard here tonight, I think a possible next direction based on what you said, Colin, as well, about the meeting tomorrow, I think a possible next direction among us on the call this evening would be to put together a 4 or 5 member group to our committee to start exploring and bringing together the ideas of everybody and maybe starting to get some concrete verbiage down on paper of how we would go about putting together this marketing co-op.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And yeah, I think the formation of a group that will work through the details will be really important and is a good next step. So do we have volunteers?
Well, obviously I'll be involved myself.
Okay.
Colin, this is Harold. I agree with what Carmen is saying, so I'd be happy to assist.
Great. And it can also be, I mean, anyone else jump in at the moment, but this is also, we have this call tomorrow, and then the goal was to host a all grower call. You might think these are all the growers, but it's not. This was just the group that Alan reached out to, and then it kind of grew a bit from there, from our last all grower weekly call. But a subsequent call after that is going to be all grower and grower only to dig into this. And so we could perhaps form that committee structure then when everybody kind of has a chance. And I would also like for you to read up on Carmen's ideas on this. He has actually put some very specific plans forward. I won't go too deep into them, but he's proposed, Carmen, correct me if I'm wrong, a marketing agency in common, housed under a family of cooperatives that would utilize an existing network of professional grain marketers of organic, transitional, and non-GMO grain. And he's proposed some structure around that as well as a pretty strong rationale for it. So I'll distribute those white papers. We'll have the call tomorrow. We'll have a subsequent all grower call specifically focused on this market structure component. And then we can formalize that committee to take on the day-to-day workings of moving that forward.
Yes, Colin, I like that idea of waiting until after tomorrow's call and then after the all growers call. Then people have a better handle on things and probably a few more key people would really want to step forth.
Okay, sounds good. Any other comments on this front? I have a few other things I'd like to say, but does that set of next steps sound good to everyone?
Yes.
Okay.
It's good to me.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
I think it's all positive and the part about a committee and also the enthusiasm of potentially us kind of becoming a group and actually following our product farther up the food chain. I think that's that creates some enthusiasm and there's promise there. I would appreciate being part of a group like that.
Good. And the last things I wanted to say, and then we can transition in the overall call agenda here, is that I would consider 2020 coming up here for the crop that's already in the ground is a very important trial year to, there are stakes involved. Some folks have commercial plots, some of you not insubstantial, but I think the main two, well, actually groups from all three clusters around the state are on this call. So I think at a cluster and cross-cluster level, really think about 2020 as an opportunity to prototype who might be a natural point person in your region, not just for supporting in-field work, but also post-harvest aggregation and storage. It's important to preserve that product quality. You know, it'd be great to see you know, fully aerated bins, separated lots. We don't want to be commingling product, so we can make sure we get those tests back well. And then coordinating the processing of that with existing processing infrastructure. Right now, the main processing options are HFI, based out in North Dakota, has a dedicated Kernza processing line, but unless they're buying from you, you're probably not going to get in their door. So there's Sprout Labs is on the line. They have told me, I don't want to speak out of turn, but they've told me that they are getting up and running to process on the scale of perhaps several hundred pounds an hour in their cleaning line as early as 2020 and are looking at ways to expand that. But for that southern Minnesota region cluster, I think you guys are an ideal partner. And we have also had preliminary conversations with both Falk Seed and a little bit with Stengel's. But I think the more that all of you on the line, if you have existing relationships with grain cleaners and processors processing your small grains, if they hear from this on you, they're going to probably take it more seriously if they hear from me about it. And even more so if they hear from you as a representative of 10 other growers. So let's think that through in 2020 about how we're going to coordinate the harvest aggregation, post-harvest handling, and on down the processing line to make sure that this goes well in 2020. Well, I think all I have to say.
I really appreciate that, Colin, you bringing it together like that. And I think you've set us in a good direction here and the next steps that we can take.
Good. So I think, Alan, it's back to you to determine how to spend the rest of our time.
Great job, Colin. I really appreciate it. So I'll just make note that at one point there were about, I think, 28 people on the call, Colin. A few folks have had to step out. We're down to, I think, 23 as the count right now. We've covered a lot of material here tonight. Jake's presentation, Jake is no longer with on the line here. But yeah, a really great presentation about really a tremendous amount of information on the agronomic, let's grow this crop, how is that going to happen, what do we need to do to grow it well, and Colin, a good presentation on the economics piece of it. That's, you know, we aren't going to do it to make ourselves just, it'll burn time. We got to do this and make money doing it. It's got to be one of our most profitable crops that we grow. I really appreciate the effort that you put into developing the enterprise budget. So that'll be a good tool to help us move forward. And then also just finally the conversation around developing the grower co-op. That is a great undertaking. And will really help move the group forward collectively, trying to get this crop to market as a new crop. It's going to take a lot of effort. So, Carmen, thank you for leading the charge on that. You had a lot of good support here tonight from the folks that are on the line, and it strikes me that that's going to continue to grow.
Yeah. Thank you, Alan.
Yeah, great job. So,
hey, Alan, I just passed it back to you, but I wanted to make one other comment. I haven't talked about it extensively because we don't have the program guidelines laid out yet, but this pilot implementation program, I want everyone on the line to know that the state of Minnesota, the legislature, has allocated $500,000 over the next 3 years to support the commercial scale-up and success of this first variety of Kernza. That might sound like a lot of money, but there's a lot of things that are going to go into that. There is going to be... for some approved growers, we haven't been able to lay out the precise eligibility guidelines yet. I think that will be done by early to mid-April for who's eligible for some cost share support on this. We've designed a two-part grower cost share payment program to both invest in growers on the front end for, you know, growing this crop and delivering some ecological services to soil and water and climate. As well as some kind of back end, more of like an insurance-like function. So essentially, because to the best of my knowledge, crop insurance is not available for Kernza right now. We've designed a insurance-like function to assume downside costs below that come in below the cost of production up to about, I think, $175 per acre. So it's about over half the cost of production if, say, you suffer an on-farm failure or failure in the marketplace. So we're gonna keep moving that forward. I'm trying to determine whether we can grandfather in plots that were planted in 2018 and after. They might say yes, they might say no. I'm gonna see if I can get the approval for not just acres based in Duisma's, but also in clusters around, you know, vulnerable areas. They might say yes, they might say no. but half of that budget is dedicated toward technical assistance. And that's not just for growing technical assistance. It can also apply to some of the post-harvest handling, aggregation, and technical support in getting this product processed. So as you think at a cluster level, regionally, about what you need, I think what that'll look like is we have some money to support to pay at least one person in the cluster to be a point person. It's not gonna be a full-time job, but you know, it'll be some type of contract that would support you to be in the field with other growers, particularly at harvest time, and also to help coordinate some of the documentation of post-harvest handling, infrastructure that people have, disseminating best practices and moving the whole thing forward. So if each cluster, say the Southern Minnesota, Southeast Minnesota cluster, identifies a good approach for that, put that in front of us and give us some ideas and we can help try to put some money behind them.
Okay, yeah, great. Well, I'm glad that you brought up the support piece of it. I did not put it on the agenda. I'm never quite sure where that's at. I know that's a moving target yet for you, but I'm really glad that you did bring it up because it does really help these early entrants into the growing of this crop become feasible as early entrants into the market. So, you know, it's getting a little bit on to the evening here. We've been talking almost for fully 2 hours here now. We originally thought that this might be a 2 hour meeting, maybe even a 2 hour, 2.5 hour meeting as a in-person meeting, but it gets a little long to be on the phone and online here talking in this way, much beyond an hour, quite frankly, for me, but we're closing in soon here on 2 hours. And I see a few people are checking off now, but I'll tell you what, if there are some, like, you know, additional burning questions that you feel like you'd like to get out here tonight, Colin is still with us, Carmen is with us, got a lot of experience growing, and let's have a few more minutes if you have questions to ask.
Yeah, I had one, following up on something Colin said, and that was about the storage and drying and so on, the possibility of aggregation. What possibilities there could be in that range if we don't have, can't meet the specific requirements on the farm. Oops, I think you're muted. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so that is, again, gonna be a cluster by cluster conversation. I mean, I know a couple people on the line don't have that infrastructure on farm. And speaking frankly, it's a big concern because even if you put a plan in place, you know, when you get the grain out of the fields, it's going to sit in a truck for a couple of days. You've got a place that you're going to put it over here, but coordinating all that, it just complexifies the whole affair. However, I will say that last year, two aggregation points fairly naturally emerged. Carmen aggregated several lots of Kernza coming out of Western Minnesota. And one of our growers in central Minnesota, Brandon Dingman, aggregated four seed lots. I do think that unless that process is done really tightly, it can have a potential to impact grain quality. I do think we saw some seed quality reductions from seed that was harvested at a farm that was publicly owned ag land. That then had to get trucked across the state. And, you know, like, I think that can really impact quality. But what I think that would look like is each cluster identifying a designated farm that has adequate storage capacity and could either pool the resources to pay that grower, or the University of Minnesota can help backfill some of those resources, perhaps. We we at least did last year. I can't commit to us doing that, but they do undertake the electricity and heating costs and labor costs of aggregating product and managing it coming in and going out to a processor. So there's costs involved, I think mostly utilities, depreciation, and labor. We have some numbers on all that, but that's the kind of thing I'd love to see each cluster take on, because you could each hold it on farm at your own place, but also when the processor comes calling, you can make one delivery of, 50 totes instead of 5 totes. It's going to make everyone's life a lot easier, so.
And I would just add to that that I mean, that's going to be one of the most important things for the group of growers as if we eventually come to this marketing co-op, we will be able to share these things, because part of the issue could potentially be that we may not be able to or may not want to commingle each producer's grain because of potential quality products or problems, but by all of us communicating among each other, we will much more easily get our hands on what the post-harvesting challenges will be, mm-hmm. and whether it's going to be a storage or a commingling or circulation. And I don't think we can really answer those questions right now, but I think as we move forward and move together, a lot of these questions and challenges will answer themselves just by our communicating with each other.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it, Carmen. And I think your point about keeping lots separate is very important. Our grain processors want to see that, even if you have multiple plots on the same farm, you harvest them, keep them separate, right? Because if you lose one, you might still, just be able to make out fine on the other. And so that's very important. It is still at this point a tote market, so you can keep that in mind in terms of scale. Although if we get to truckloads, I think they'd be perhaps happy to deal with truckloads. So,
Right. We talk about tote markets, but maybe too many of us think in terms of semi-load lots, but a lot of us still operate in tandem size trucks, which would fit, if we got 20 to 30 to 40 acre plots, a tandem would probably take care of quite a few of those.
Mm-hmm. But are the processors willing to take a tandem truck? I think that's what your comment is directed at. And so it's kind of like getting it clean, getting it dry, getting it clean, getting it put in totes and stored inside of a shop.
Now, and again, like I said, the high level message is that this is an early adopter situation. So everything it is now is likely to change. So you're on this kind of pioneer track. But as I understand it, even the larger processor is taking it in totes and processing it as such, because that can also preserve grain quality a bit better and allow them to deal with any quality issues that might arise. They even see quality issues within, the same lot, and they've been able to separate that out a bit just by toting it out.
Our grain this fall, our last fall, went down the road in a semi with 16 totes in it.
Right.
Carmen?
Yes.
So if you're going to tote size or what I'm considering, once it's through the combine, when it comes to an air floor facility to continue drying it, aren't we going to need to re-clean that to get some of the chaff out as we put it in that bin? And also, one other thing that comes to mind, because I'm a fabricator by nature, if it goes into totes, would it be advantageous to use like seed pro boxes and then also have a small ventilation fan that could hook onto the bottom port of those? You'd slide the slide open and you'd be able to aerate in those totes.
Yeah, Jake's been using these tube fans. He's not on the phone anymore.
Sure.
But he's been kind of dropping those into in the totes, and they've been lugging those around the state for the last couple of years as their strategy.
Right.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could set it on a small squirrel cage fan, this tote, and then open the slide and you could blow air from the bottom, because it just, at the kind of moisture you guys are talking, I'm kind of concerned that we wouldn't want it sitting on trucks too long. Right. And also, you know, you want to get some air to it fairly quick, and I think you'd have a good success rate on getting your product quality there, keeping it.
No, we, our grain was at about 13% when we harvested, so it wasn't, the moisture wasn't,
okay,
wasn't an issue, and then we just put it in a bin with a full floor aeration, and then just kept, yep, air on it for a little bit, you know, for a few days or whatever. And then if the company that wanted it would have taken it in bulk, we would have dumped it on our tandem and hauled it there. But they did,
sure,
not have bulk facilities yet, so that's why we had to do it in tandem. But they were thinking about being ready for taking bulk facility or bulk loads already this coming year, but it's never over till it's over.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Anything else, anybody?
I would just want, just for those who are on here, as far as producers, take some time between now and harvest to investigate the stripper head as a possible harvest tool. My experience last year of all three, windrowing, straight cutting, and stripping, I would really recommend we look in the direction of the stripper head as the best option.
Carmen, this is Scott.
Yes.
I talked to the guy down south that's their Shelburne Reynolds dealer.
Okay.
I talked to him last fall after me and you talked that time about the stripper head. And he laughed at me a little bit because he said we were getting behind. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, these hemp guys are calling me from all over the country wanting all my small stripper heads. And I said, well, save me one and just send it up here so they don't get it. And he laughed. And, you know, the smallest one he has available today is a 24 foot.
Okay.
All of the smaller ones that he had are gone now. He said even the junk ones they bought.
Well, this might be far-fetched, but that might be a challenge for this group of farmers that hopefully gets together to figure out how we can share some of these strips,
yeah,
around the cluster, too.
Yeah. And the guy was very helpful and very talkative. You know, because I pointed out to him that there was a couple other stripper heads on Tractor House that were way cheaper than his. And he laughed at me. He says, all ours have been through the shop. Everything's been fixed, changed, replaced, and they got a full year warranty. He says, you can buy one of them other ones, but he said, it's going to cost you some money to get it up to snuff.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I understand that, you know. He said, I have trouble spending that kind of money for something that I'm going to use for an hour. I realize that's exaggeration, maybe, but you know, you guys know what I mean.
Oh yeah,
I agree with the sharing thing.
Do you think there's been any success out there with like 20 foot bean platforms with air reels on them, cutting it high?
That I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either. I know I watched the Draper head work, and it worked just fine as far as bringing,
okay,
the grain. That worked just fine. But the biggest thing I noticed is that with the stripper head, and it gets significant, you get, I guess I should back up. What I found in harvesting the kerns is that the stem is grass green yet, and the head is ripe. And so the less green stem you can get in there, the better quality grain you get.
Correct. Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think if it's a non-draper head and you're trying to cut cut the grain near the top. The shorter you cut grain, the more it'll bunch on your header.
Yep.
So I suppose you'd need a draper, not an auger head, and then I'd just wonder about the shatter if an air reel would help. If these stripper heads are so doggone premium, and I hear what you guys are saying, a 20-footer is intriguing, but a 24 is the smallest available. You could probably buy a lot of 35-footers, but what the heck do you do with that?
I got a torch.
Yeah, we'll cut the ends off it. Yep.
Then we can share.
On the other hand, sharing isn't so much out of the picture in a cluster because
correct.
You can travel 6 to 8 miles an hour with that stripper head. And so you're going to get over a good number of acres even in one day.
Well, for instance, I just talked to him a few days ago again because I looked online to see what was available now, you know, 2-3 months after I'd looked at it the last time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's got a 10-year-old that has been through their shop, 10-year-old head, 24 foot, and I'm pretty sure we could buy it for 20 grand. And it's got a year warranty, and it looks like new. You know, I told him, I said, that's fine, but I don't know where I'm going to get the $19,900 that I need to buy it.
Right.
But that's really not bad compared to 50, 60, 80,000, which I've seen prices on some of those heads.
Is there any grants out there that would allow us to purchase it?
I think MDA has a, they have a 25% reimbursement on capital expenses for, I think, new markets, right? So those were there. I can go back to that implementation budget, and they were pretty hesitant about capital costs, and all public grants are always a big thing, right? So I'll look into that. It was almost all dedicated toward acre level cost share and technical assistance, but I'll see if there's anything in there. If there is, it might be like 10 grand max. And I can't even say that for sure.
Be careful how you word that request, because if they hear that we're looking for a grant to buy strippers, somebody is going to have a problem with that.
Okay. Yeah, they'll tell you the price of brass is out of this world. We're not going with that. Yep.
Yeah.
6 feet away. I mean, it's okay, right?
Yeah.
The right.
Alan.
Yes, sir.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, what about, is there any way to pull in Minnesota Water Quality Certification Board with their the grant they give the individual people that qualify for the cover crop money?
And you're thinking on the purchase.
You get that once you're certified, you get that grant money for cover cropping. I wonder, you know, they could almost consider shifting some of that to purchase a stripper head.
I'm doubtful on that one, Mike. But I mean,
they're pretty regimented.
Yeah, I like the creative thinking there, but I'm doubtful that it would apply. There's one that's running through my mind. I believe it's a SARE grant that does allow. For some reason, $14,000 runs through my mind. We were interested in looking for a source of funding that might help purchase twin row planters for this wide row. Corn project that we've got going. Mike, are you familiar with that project?
Yep. I
don't think Bill might have checked off here now, but Bill helped out in terms of writing a grant, sort of MDA grant actually, but we were interested in where could we find some funds that would help maybe purchase a twin row corn planter and experiment with different corn row widths and interseeding with cover crops. And it strikes me that SARE, that's the Sustainable Ag Research and Education branch, it's, I believe USDA branch, and they provide farmer grants for doing farm research. And part of the grant money can be used to purchase equipment. Mm-hmm. And there's a limit to the total amount. And it strikes me there was some odd number, like $14,000. If Colin, if you think that it's worth digging into, I certainly will.
Yeah. Yeah, I would.
It would have to be tied to some specific research piece. So, you know, that might be the particular one. What we're looking for, correct me if I'm wrong here, folks, but what we're looking for is a piece of equipment that we could bring into use and then share among growers, right?
Yeah, and I think
it's the classic opportunity for a custom operator to come on board and say, hey, I've got this piece of equipment, I'll travel. And, you know, I don't know how do we, you know, to me it's kind of a simple one.
What do you guys like behind these heads for this crop? What type of machine? Is it conventional cylinder or axial flow?
Yeah, that was going to be my question.
We only used axial flow on all three of them, but last summer, but the adjustments is about the same. All we did when we adjusted the axial flow is we tightened it up until we could hear the clicking, and then just backed it off so we wouldn't hear the clicking, and turned the fan down, and that's the adjustment that you do on almost any of them. I don't know if there's any big difference, but I would think that the axial flow would be the better one, though.
I was throw a few cover plates in your first concave, I would imagine, but you didn't need any special sieves or anything.
No, we didn't. I checked with several people on that because somebody told me we did, and they said no. You're better off not doing anything special on the sieves or anything like that.
Sure. Okay.
I just wanted to add that those Shelbourne Reynolds, they have a different mounting head for different color machines. But
sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Alan, I don't mind at all asking around on this funding front because all the partners we're working with, I mean, the whole pitch here is that we're trying to deliver, with a lot of these partners, we're talking about delivering environmental benefit through new crop adoption. That's my son.
Hey, hi there.
Hey, my farmer friends.
Best looking guys meeting. Yeah.
But anyways, the point is that we're
the smartest one. I'm the smartest one, Mike.
Yeah,
he hasn't done anything wrong yet, farming.
We're trying to deliver these benefits through crop adoption. And so in order to do that, we need to equip growers with the right equipment, right?
Yes,
so,
sure.
I don't have any problem in inquiring around as to whether we can – I can't promise I'll deliver $20,000, but just let you know I'm going to take this back to our leadership and say, you know, they tell us to go out and tell them what we need
good.
To get things on the landscape, right? So I'll make some asks on that front. And I had one other question. For the group here. You know, I mentioned available processors. I don't know if Christopher Abbott's still on the line. I know he's trying to scale up a bit, but we also don't want to inundate him with all the kernza in the state. So I'm wondering if, is there anyone on the line that has any small or mid-scale, small grain processors they already work with that you would recommend that we continue to take this to? We go out with samples, specs, process flow, bring the engineer from ARI. Is there anyone else you want to put on our radar that we could get kernza in their lineup?
That time of year, I wonder if what could the Myers brothers down by Potsdam do for us? They cleaned our seed dunes this year for Legend Seeds Incorporated, but that time of year, I don't think they're cleaning too much.
You said the Myers brothers?
It's Myers Seed Cleaning. Yeah, they're in the big town of Potsdam. You can look them up. I've only dealt with them 1 year, but they were a joy to work with this spring. And they come to mind as a hands-on seed cleaning family that's been in it since about 1910
okay.
or 1908.
Okay.
And they're not enormous, but just get back to me what you may need, and then we both feel smarter and make a few phone calls.
Okay.
And I assume
there's another seed cleaner down in Lyle, Minnesota. Grass and Sons, I believe, is the name. And then I'm about 5 miles away from another seed business, Angel Seed Farm, and he does a lot of cleaning.
John.
They're pushing with it, but that's about it.
Yeah, particularly
right out of Geneva there. Yeah, John has cleaned the beans a couple years for us too. He does a good job.
He's actually going to clean some transitional rye for me. But he's not into organic, so I don't know. But like I said, you'd have to just run it by him and see if that's something he's interested in. So.
Okay.
Sure.
And I think, Colin, Cal Sprock, I think once we start moving a little bit more, would be a little interested again.
Good. That's good. And I think in any of these, particularly anyone who's doing food grade, food safe facility, you know, that's taking any of these small grains, flax and other, you know, items into food markets are ideal partners.
Right, right. Well, I've got to run.
Yeah. It sounds like it.
Yep. Okay. So we've lost about 10 people. And we gained one.
Thanks, Alan, for putting this together. I really appreciate it.
And welcome, and thank you all for being present. And again, Carmen, lead the charge on the, you know, getting the growers organized and moving in the right direction. So terrific there. Thank you all for attending tonight. And, you know, good luck moving forward. I hope that here locally, I can help provide information to, you know, growers that are currently working and folks that are interested in becoming growers. So, Colin, thanks so much for your help and all of that.
Oh, no, thank you. Great meeting. Take care, everyone.
Yep.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Have a good evening, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Good night.
Goodbye. Good night.